Well, I want to start off by thanking the organizers for and KITP in general for inviting me here to talk to you about lattice supersymmetry. And of course, it's always nice to escape from winter in upstate New York as well, albeit for just a couple of weeks. So I'm going to talk to you about lattice supersymmetry. Since the audience is pretty broad here, I'm going to be, I hope, reasonably pedagogical. I'll try to give you a discussion of why formulating supersymmetric theories on lattices is difficult, traditionally at least, and I'll indicate what the new developments have been in the last 5 to 10 years now, which have really dramatically changed the picture. So now we have a series of constructions which allow us to maintain at least a part of the supersymmetry exactly at non-zero lattice spacing. So I'll try to indicate how that works. I'll give some details of the typical constructions of these lattice actions. I won't cover all possibilities. I'll specialize to the sort of things I've worked on. But I will try to focus that discussion towards the end on the most interesting of theories, of course, N equals 4 Young-Miller. So that will take at least half of the talk. Towards the second half, I'll try to bring up some of the remaining concerns. So at this point, you'll realize that we have reasonable theoretical constructions of these supersymmetric lattice theories. But there are one or two things we sort of shoved under the rug at various points. And so those are things we've been worrying about in the last year or so in trying to actually conduct practical numerical simulations. So I'll talk about those here. And then if I have time, I'll at least give you one simple example of how you can apply some of these new lattice constructions to study issues in holography, gauge gravity, duality, and things like that. Okay, so why bother? Why are we interested in formulating supersymmetric theories on lattices? Well, of course, the first thing that strikes one is one would like a non-perturbative definition of what you mean by supersymmetric theory. It should function in the same way that lattice QCD does for QCD, something which is defined outside of perturbation theory. So when I take the lattice spacing to zero and the number of points to infinity, that is what I mean by my supersymmetric theory. Okay, so I would like to have a formulation which is not tied to perturbation theory in principle. If I have such a formulation, I might hope that things like strong coupling expansions and Monte Carlo simulation can be used to explore the non-perturbative structure of those theories. And of course, one of the most obvious things that one would like the lattice for is to study issues like, for example, dynamical supersymmetry breaking. So there are lots of theorems that tell you this can't really go on in perturbation theory. If it's not violating the tree level, then typically it's hard to break SUSY in perturbation theory. But of course, non-perturbative effects are precisely where the lattice potentially can play a role. And then, of course, most recently we have all the connections to AES, CFT, and holography, and general ideas about quantum gravity. So it's possible that if we understand how to do supersymmetric Young-Mills theories better, we may even get some in this discrete form. We may even get some insight onto the problem of quantum gravity itself. Although we're a long way from that at the moment, I would say. Okay, so what's the problem? Why isn't everybody doing this? Well, the problem is obvious, and it was known a lot. People tried to put supersymmetric theories on lattices in the very early days of lattice gauge theory, with essentially no success, and it's very obvious why. The algebra of supersymmetry closes on infinitesimal generators of translations, lambda. And of course, as soon as you go to a lattice, you have no infinitesimal generators of translations. So you break that algebra at the classical level right away. There's an equivalent way of stating it, that the Leibniz rule no longer holds when you replace derivatives by difference operators. Okay, if you try to naively lattice a supersymmetric theory, that's where you immediately see there's a problem. You can no longer reorganize terms into total derivatives in the way you would in the continuum, and you get a breaking of supersymmetry at the classical level. So the problem, of course, is the quantum mechanics. Once one breaks the symmetry at the classical level, quantum effects generally generate everything, any possible SUSY-violating term you want. And there are usually very many of these things. A subset of those guys are what are called relevant operators. So what that means in the context of lattice work is that once one has a relevant SUSY-breaking operator in your lattice action, you're going to tune its coupling as you take the lattice spacing to zero to remove its effect in the continuum limit. And again, typically there are large numbers of these relevant SUSY-breaking operators, and this problem of fine-tuning is essentially, for most situations, is insuperable. There are too many of these operators to deal with, and there is little chance of actually doing this. There are one or two exceptions to this. For example, n equals 1 Yang-Mills can be fine-tuned because there's only one relevant operator. But in most cases, particularly cases involving scalar fields, there are generally very many. And so it's very difficult. So that's the problem. And it resisted solution for a long time. So let me immediately cut to the chase and tell you what the solution, the characteristics of the new solutions to this problem. What are they? They all involve what's called twisted supersymmetry. So the idea is you have to twist the theory, and I'll tell you what that is in detail in a second, in such a way that you can extract out from it a subalgebra which has a much simpler structure than the usual Suzy algebra. So there are one or more nilpotent scalar supercharges in the theory, so charges that square to zero. Now, so as soon as you have that, you have an improvement over traditional supersymmetric constructions because you have no P on the right-hand side, which immediately is broken. So this is already an advantage. You get a bonus when you twist a theory like this. Typically, the actions of these twisted theories are Q-exact, have this sort of Q-exact form, which means that if you can maintain this nilpotent property when you discretize the theory, then the action's automatically going to be invariant under that Q. All right. We'll see when we talk about n equals 4 that actually you have to add some dot dots here. So it's not always exactly Q-exact. But nevertheless, it's still supersymmetric, as I'll show you. Okay? So supersymmetry in this language is actually rather easy to deal with. You can actually build, you can maintain this nilpotent property rather easily. And in fact, the difficulties now are making sure that you maintain gauge invariance. The structure of lambda has to be chosen carefully to make sure the actions are lattice gauge invariant. And you also have to worry about problems like fermion doubling, which are, of course, are well known in the lattice QCD community. So the problem with fermion doubling is, roughly speaking, that there are modes in the spectrum of your discrete Dirac operator which have no counterpart in the continuum spectrum and do not go away to take the lattice space into zero. So you end up with too many fermions in your continuum theory from what you actually wanted. And of course, this is something you also have to simultaneously deal with. Now, in some sense, any lattice action which is supersymmetric must solve that problem. Because assuming the bosons are not doubling, the fermions must not double because supersymmetry will pair the states. So in some sense, this has to come along for free, providing you choose lambda in some appropriate way. And I'll show you what that is. So there's been a lot of work done over more than 5 years now. This goes back almost 10 years at this point. A lot of people have contributed. Trouble with giving a list like this is one's bound to leave several people off. I hope nobody is in the audience. but there are about 70 papers in the last 5+ years in this, all of which have basically used some form of twisted supersymmetry in the end construct these supersymmetric lattice theories. Okay, so this is a sort of common element to almost all of these constructions. The models I'll talk about were actually first constructed using Oberfold methods, Oberfold and deconstruction methods by Mittag, Unsoil, and David Kaplan in about 2003 or 4, at least in the case of four and eight superchargers. This twisting process actually works even when you don't have Yang-Mills symmetry, and in those cases, the Oberfold methods don't work. But what I'll show you is, we'll discuss it entirely within the context of topological twisting, and we'll see the actions you get to are actually identical to those uncovered by Kaplan and Unsoil back then. Okay, so that's the final slide in some sense, but now I'll show you how it all works. So let me give you perhaps the simplest example that illustrates what's going on. Think about two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory with four superchargers. So this contains two Majorana fermions which transform under an SO2 of flavor. You can rotate the two fermions into each other. And of course, in Euclidean space, there's another SO2 as well, like a rotational symmetry, Euclidean Lorentz symmetry. There's an additional SO2 in this theory, but we don't even need it for this construction. So if I take those spinners, and I imagine what happens to them when I do both rotation in space and flavor rotation, and this is of course what happens. So they rotate under R and then F in flavor space, and you can see that under the diagonal subgroup, when R is F, then lambda basically is transforming like a matrix. That's the key observation. All right. So the fermions in this theory contains two degenerate Majoranas automatically behave if I do under this combined rotation in space and in flavor space transform like a matrix. Once you have a matrix, it's natural to decompose it on products of gamma matrices, and so we'll end up with a piece which is proportional to the unit matrix, a piece proportional to gamma in two dimensions, sigma in this case, the Pauli matrix, and then products of sigma 1, sigma 2, and then you're done. Okay, then you have the 4 degrees of freedom you actually need. And so what you immediately see is that is the appearance of this scalar fermion. That's crucial, basically. It's the appearance of this scalar fermion which is correlated to the appearance of a scalar supercharge, not surprisingly. And so you've replaced your original spinners in terms of now in terms of tensor fields. So this is the essence of twisting. You have to decompose all the fields in your theory, not under the original rotation group, but under this twisted combination here. And then you will see automatically when you do the same twist, when you do the same transformation for the superchargers, you'll end up with a Q scalar supercharge.
And if you like the Dirac-Kähler thing?
It's exactly Dirac-Kähler. It's another way. Dirac-Kähler is what the fermion action will be. So that's a discussion of what happens to the fermions in the theory. They get represented by tensor fields in the twisted language. The original gauge field, of course, is a singlet under flavor, and so it remains a vector under this twisted rotation group, this diagonal rotation group of the two SO2s. The original theory also had two scalar fields in it. That's natural because it comes from dimensional reduction of n equals 1 in 4 dimensions, so you get two scalar fields automatically in the theory. And they transformed into vector representation of the flavor group. So what happens is they started off as singlets under this SO2, and vectors under this SO2, so under the SO2 prime, they're also vectors. So you can think of them as a field B mu, in the way they transform under the twisted group. So that's roughly speaking how the bosons in theory go. In fact, what happens in all the constructions that have been looked at so far is that what happens is that the entire bosonic content of the twisted theory can be seen in terms of a single complex gauge field. So the original gauge field gets combined with the scalar fields to yield a complex A. And so you can write the bosonic action entirely in terms of things like the field strength tensor conjugate to A. I mean, there's no way to see that immediately from the first two bulleted points, but it turns out to always be the case. Okay, so here in this two-dimensional example I was talking about, this is the explicit form of the lambda. All right, so S is Q on something, and here is the something. All right, so it involves this twisted fermion. This was the chi-1-2 that I showed you in a couple of slides back. It's coupled to curly F. Curly F is just the usual commutator of curly covariant derivatives. The scalar fermion is coupled to a dB bar commutator, and then there's an additional auxiliary field D that gets introduced as well. And this is the explicit form of the supersymmetry. So the supersymmetry changes curly psi, curly A into psi. Psi is a singlet. A bar is also a singlet, so A bar, which involves A minus I B, where A and B are the gauge fields and scalars. That's also a singlet. Chi transforms into minus F bar. I'm using anti-emission generators here, if you care. That's what the minus sign is related to. Eta goes into D, and D is also a singlet. So it's a very, very simple transformation. It's very easy to see that it's nilpotent. If I do two applications of Q on A, I get zero, and similarly here. Because this is a function only of A bar, so Q squared on chi is also zero. So this is the form of the action. You may not be convinced this is the original Young-Mills theory yet, but I'll show you that in a second. But this is I'm just writing down the answer and we'll work backwards. Okay. All right? So we're still in the continuum, we're not on the lattice yet. Okay? If you want to see that this is really the original theory, then you do that Q variation. In the definition of the action, and you integrate out the D field, it's just an auxiliary. And what you end up with is a term like this. You end up with an FF bar term, where these are still the curly Fs, the square of the commutator of DD bar, and then this sort of Taylor-Dirac structure for the fermions. All right? Now, if you're willing to then do a little integration by parts, you can add these two terms together with this specific coefficient, and you find it collapses to the usual x squared involving just a, the usual gauge field. You get a term coming from the imaginary part of a, which looks like b box b. And so you can see immediately that's just like the original kinetic term for two scalar fields. There's the usual forwarding interaction, which is buried inside of that bar, and then there's some fermions. You can rebuild spinners out of these funny twisted fermions in this way. So you can build a two-component spinner out of psi 1 and psi 2, the two components of psi. You can bung the eta and the chi together to make another spinner. And you can just write out these terms, and you rapidly see they have a Dirac structure. So they look like gamma dot d plus some Yukawa terms. And in fact, these Yukawa terms are precisely correct to correspond to Yukawas you would get from dimensional reduction at n equals 1 in four dimensions in a chiral basis. So you can confirm that this fancy way of writing the theory up here is nothing more than the usual theory if you're willing to just change variables. So you should think of this twisting process in flat space as simply being a convenient change of variables. And there's no new physical content in the theory at this point. It's going to be more convenient, a more convenient parameterization of the theory for discretization. So that's why it's important from the lattice perspective.
Could I just say that I start from n equals 1 in four dimensions and just make two directions?
Yeah. You know,
just a single loop
uh-huh.
like this without thinking.
You could disregard. Yeah, you can simply just think of this as a change of variables. It's very perverse, but you could work backwards.
No, on the lattice, if you're an n equals 1...
Because I know how to do it on the lattice.
Yes, but it's important you finally end up in two dimensions. It's important you end up with two scalar fields and not just four gauge fields. This construction doesn't work.
You take a lattice, which is L squared mm-hmm. times 1 squared. Mm-hmm. And you put the same action you would put on an L squared times k.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And that one, but then it means that the argument that the n equals 1 in four dimensions is enough to just ensure masslessness of the forks of the joint guys. That argument is not the same as having q squared equals 0.
Right. I mean, the whole notion of the twisted rotation group really only applies in two dimensions. So you don't have the understanding that Q is really a scalar and if you work directly in the four-dimensional theory. But the field content
is the same.
Yeah.
Then you would use the chiral fermions on the lattice in four dimensions, which is a water condition. Mm-hmm. Right? It's basically, that's the same condition.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then go equals.
Actually, in fact, Gabriele Veneziano, in fact, found a gauge fixing, I think an axial gauge fixing of n equals 1, which admitted what was called a local Nicolai map many years ago. And theorists which have local Nicolai maps actually have a twisted interpretation. So I think there is a direct construction of the which exhibits a nilpotent supersymmetry in four dimensions. The problem is, I'm trying to recall now. The problem is that the axial gauge fixing they use has hermeticity problems. It's hard to keep the gauge fields real. So there's some funny business that goes on, and they end up working in a funny signature. So
I think what Herbert is asking is what about the scalars? Normally, n equal 1 doesn't require any fine tuning in four dimensions. This is what you're asking. Yeah. So if you go to two dimensions, it looks like this dimensional reduction. If you just do it in the n equal 1 bracket, there are no scalars. But that's, of course, not true. You have them there.
Well, there are still scalars.
The Polyakov loops. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they become the scalars.
Yeah. What can they do? They transform under the joint.
Right.
And they have no, they don't rotate in triangles under the remaining group. But then you can do the same thing starting from 10 dimensions with n equals 1, get n equals 4.
It's as close in spirit, of course, to what the orthogonal constructions do, where they go down to zero dimensions from that mother theory and then rebuild the lattice up by an orthogonal procedure.
Only that in that case, you have a little problem with the action of the engaging value. Because of the anomaly.
Oh.
But the anomaly probably goes away because of the...
Well,
killing six, I mean, the full compactification of the takes away the boundary layers.
Right, I mean, you end up with vectors in lower dimensions.
Right.
So they're not only there are some interesting questions as to exactly what happens.
But it will give you the right answer.
I think so. Yeah. Now I see. Okay, just a couple of comments, which are not important really for the rest of the talk, but you may be interested anyway. I mean, this Q and this Q exact structure of the action, of course, is very reminiscent of BRSD gauge fixing. And in fact, you can quote, derive these actions by gauge fixing an underlying bosonic theory, which has a very large topological invariance. Basically, you can shift the gauge field by an arbitrary amount. And when you gauge fix and pick the right gauge fixing conditions, you can, quote, derive the Supiang-Mills action that we had on the previous slide. So that's an interesting sideline, but it's not important from our perspective. What perhaps is a bit more important is the fact that if you look at bands of Q-invariant operators, then you can show in the continuum, of course, they're independent of the metric and they're independent of the coupling constant. So you can compute them in the semi-classical limit, they're sort of topological in nature. And actually, this is useful when you come to working with the lattice theory, because it means there's a sector of the lattice theory where you know the answer. So when you're trying to get your simulations to give you to work, it's useful to have some hard numbers that they have to hit. And I will show you some evidence of that later on, and I show you a few numerical results. So it's actually kind of useful to have these things in there.
You're working with non-compact gauge.
Non-compact, because they're complex.
Right. But in the story that I was telling you, it will stay compact.
Yeah. Let's talk later. That's interesting. I haven't really thought in detail about exactly how you would do that. But it is interesting that there actually was a lot of work done before really people knew about topological field theory, just in terms of Nicolai maps. And the N equals 1 theory does have a local Nicolai map if you fix the gauge appropriately. And there is an nilpotent SUSY that you can extract out from that. So I think it's very much related to what you're saying.
But for the Nicolai map, it's essential that it's a flat measure for the scales.
Yeah.
You can't deal with something that lives on a loop manifold and
you know. Yeah, we're not going to live on a loop manifold. We're going to live in the algebra. In fact, I'll show you. That's one of the issues we've been worrying about in the last year or so. Exactly how long does it?
The algebra still exists. The passing laws for everything finite exists. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
Because you know there are this commutator. You know,
yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that.
Even for finite
angular lenses. Yes, in general. In fact, actually, you can think of just in terms of the matrix model limit. And there was work done by Staudacker and Nicolai again many years ago in the matrix model limit showing some of these intervals were.
But not for everything. It depends on the.
They did the Q equals 16 case.
No, I meant it depends on what you put downstairs, what the observable is.
Yeah, they were mostly just computing moments of eigenvalue distributions and the partition function.
Right. If you want something physically, maybe another doesn't work, but that's not.
So, there probably are some divergent quantities, but the physical quantities are finite.
But it's very simple. You know, your world identity is identifying everything, connecting the guys that diverge with the guys that don't.
Yeah.
Sorry.
As I say, there are still some things that we don't fully understand. I mean, practical things and also theoretical issues, actually. And that falls into that category. So this topological sector exists even in the lattice theory. Of course, you don't really have a metric in lattice theory, but nevertheless, certainly the coupling constant independence is quite useful in certain cases for testing that you have a good supersymmetric action. But it's important that really, when you think of this twisting, it's just a change of variables. So we're not going to restrict ourselves to Q-invariant states as you would in a traditional BRSC gauge fixing sort of scenario. We're just going to treat it as a change of variables. And in flat space, that's quite legitimate. Of course, in curved space, it's a different theory. But that's not what we're doing. All right, so let me go on and tell you a bit about how we go about transforming this continuum twisted theory onto a lattice. So typically what happens is the fields get assigned to links of the lattice. So every field in the theory gets associated with a link on the lattice. So and then it will transform in a canonical way a link field would, just like the gauge link in ordinary lattice QCD. So when you gauge transform, this field will pick up a factor of g at the one end of the link, and if you dagger at the other end. Okay, this mu here is associated with a particular field form here. Okay, so in the two-dimensional case I talked about, so you have to have, this is one unit cell of the lattice if you want, so you end up with obviously an x and a y direction, but you also need some place to put the chi's. So the chi's would naturally be associated with plaquettes, but rather than putting, which would mean the center of this square, but rather than doing that, you actually insert a diagonal link and associate the chi with that diagonal link.
Okay.
So clearly the u's, just a quote, are associated with the positive coordinate directions. The u bars just run the opposite way, of course. The psi's are superpartners of the u's, so they are little on the links as well. So psi 1 is here and psi 2 is here. The chi, as I say, is associated with this link. There's an issue of orientation. Once you go to the lattice, there's two orientations you can choose for each fermion. So the psi's have to be oriented positively, and the chi's are actually oriented negatively. Now, the reason for that you'll see in just a moment. The field strength tensor I define will have a positive orientation. I need to contract it with a chi. So to make a gauge invariant loop on the lattice, I need to choose the chi to point the opposite way than the natural f that comes up. Okay. So the orientation is not free, determined by gauge invariants in the end. All right. You take the Suzy transformations to be precisely the same as the continuum. So they're nilpotent for exactly the same reasons they are in the continuum. So that's most of what you need to construct the lattice action. The only other piece you need, and it's a crucial piece, is you need a dictionary to translate these continuum covariant derivatives into gauge covariant difference operators. So there's a precise dictionary. It was actually written down in a totally different context many, many years ago by Eratan and collaborators, where they were thinking about how to gauge adjoint fields. Everything is in the adjoint, of course. So we just use that directly. It turns out to be exactly the prescription that follows from the overfolding as well. But the game is the following. Suppose I set the u's to 1 for a second, then you can see that this is just a difference operator, a forward difference operator acting on this particular field psi. Okay? Then you pre and post multiply by these u's in such a way that both of these products transform the same way under lattice gauge transformations. In fact, they both transform like an object with indices mu and nu, which in this case is a diagonal length. So, for example, this will transform just in the right way to contract with a chi mu nu to give a gauge invariant loop on the lattice. So this prescription exists for any number of derivatives on any p-form field. I won't write it all down, but there's a very simple a form for it. In general, what happens is the derivatives are always roughly commutators of u with the field, and the only question is how you point split those commutators to give you back derivatives in the continuum. So if you expand this u field around the unit matrix plus the fluctuation, then this thing clearly collapses to the adjoint covariant derivative in the limit of the lattice space in terms of zero. So it has the right naive continuum limit. It's covariant on the lattice gauge transformations. Those two rules are enough to basically determine how those derivatives have to fall. Okay? In fact, the f mu nu that appears in the lattice action is just d plus acting on u with this rule. So it's actually automatically antisymmetric in the indices mu and nu when you plug it in. It follows automatically. So it's actually a rather elegant prescription, and it generalizes in any way you need for any type of twisted action that you need. The other issue that I have to tell you a little bit more about is how fermion doubling is evaded in all of this. So this the prescription was written down again in a different context many years ago by Jeff Rabin, Becker, Hughes, and people like that in the early 80s. In the early days of lattice gauge theory, if you have an action which is written in terms of forms like this, and you want to discretize it so that you don't have any fermion doubling, so the solutions converge uniformly to the continuum as you take the lattice space into zero, you simply replace these when they're acting in curl-like operations, like an exterior derivative, by a forward difference. And if it's in a divergence, like an AD dagger, the adjoint of the exterior derivative becomes a D minus. You make this transformation everywhere throughout your action, you automatically get an action, get a spectrum which is free of doublers. And in fact, what you will derive is the lattice Taylor-Dirac action. And that action can be mapped into the action for a staggered fermion, as well, speaking. And so it doesn't double for the same reason that staggered fermions don't double. It's important that this action, of course, describes more than one fermion in general. You haven't gotten around that problem. You can't write down an action which describes a single fermion here. It's going to describe multiples of degenerate fermions, but that's what you need for these super young Lewis theories. So there's a place for all of that degeneracy in the staggered fork action in these theories. So for example, in n equals 4, there will be 4 Majorana fermions, and you'll have exactly, in the continuum limit, this action will give you 4 fields.
It still has case splitting
and it still has case splitting in QCD language. And in fact, it's not regular staggered fermions, it's reduced staggered fermions. So we get 4 Majorana fermions, not 4 Dirac. So it's 2 Dirac. Okay, so in fact, if you start writing down these discrete derivatives, you can map them into a staggered action. What you're mapping it into is a reduced staggered action. So which is absolutely the minimum number of fermions you can fit in at that point. And it'd have to be massless, which is also true for these types of theories that all have no mass terms. Okay, so let's see how all this ports over to n equals 4, which of course is the interesting case. And of course in n equals 4, the twisted rotation group will be something like SO4 prime. So you'll twist a subgroup of the R symmetry. This is SO6 R symmetry, but you'll need SO4 on it. You can twist that with the Euclidean rotation group to give an SO4 prime. So you'll have a matrix of fermions, and you'll be able to expand that out on products of gamma matrices, just like before. And you can do all of that, but actually it turns out to be even more compact to re-express a theory as the dimensional, that the Yang-Mills theory is a dimensional reduction of 5 dimensions. So I can pack my 16 fermions into an eta, psi, and a chi, where these indices go from 1 to 5, and the bosons, I have 10 of them because I have 6 scalars and 4 gauge fields, end up as 5 complex gauge fields. So it turns out that twisted theory can be written incredibly simply, as even in the continuum, as a naive dimensional reduction of a 5-dimensional theory whose action, forgetting about this term for a second, is exactly the same form as that 2-dimensional example, except the indices run over wide ranges. So it's a very, very compact way of writing n equals 4 down, actually. And it's what we do when we latticize it. So the only question is, it's not quite good enough to just take a Q-exact piece. It turns out there's one Q-closed term you can write down, which you couldn't do in 2 dimensions. It involves contracting these ties together with a D-bar and this epsilon. And so this is supersymmetric because chi rotates into an F-bar, and so the Bianchi identity vanish guarantees that that's actually supersymmetric without being Q-exact. But everything I said, it almost goes over. And indeed, the code, you dial in this integer, whether you want to do the two-dimensional theory in our code or the four-dimensional theory, it's just a question of a hash define. that's how similar it is.
What is the coefficient?
The coefficient of?
Disposed.
Oh, there is a special, yeah, you just have to make, this coefficient is important to tune it so that you can untwist the theory and get back to n equals 4. It's not true for an arbitrary coefficient. So it's very important that this. Good question. The fermion operator, you will not get n equals 4.
Get something.
Get something. It'll leave me supersymmetric under the Q. In fact, you can actually ask a more general question. Suppose I put arbitrary coefficients in these Q exact terms. That's actually what we do because we did a perturbative study of exactly how those coefficients would normalize, because it's related to whether supersymmetry or the supersymmetry comes back. So I'll talk about that later. And I don't have a good physical interpretation of what the theory is if you perturb away from n equals 4. It has reduced supersymmetry, but does it go from n equals 4 down to n equals a quarter, which is what you were building in from the outset, or intermediate levels? It's actually an interesting question to do in the continuum, actually. Because at long loop, it turns out the divergences of the lattice theory are the same as the continuum. So you could ask this question even in the continuum and see what the fixed point structure was. Because it could be it's not trivial.
It may not be Lorentzian variant also, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's probably, that's
which
almost
is
certainly true.
Which is
that's
peculiar.
Almost certainly true, right?
Observation, but sort
yeah.
Of.
Yeah.
Might not be Lorentzian variant.
If you don't put the 1/8 or...
No.
When you untwist it, it will break the Lorentz symmetry in general, I think. Because the n equals 4 supersymmetry is very much tied to that, right? So if you're breaking some of the n equals 4 down, you're probably breaking Lorentz symmetry as well. But so I don't know what happens. Maybe the theory becomes some lower dimensional theory. You know, some of the dimensions are smaller than others, shrinked at the top. I don't know. Anyway, it's an interesting thing to think about. So going to the lattice is just the same. I showed you the action is formally just the same, virtually as the two-dimensional example. So I have five complex gauge fields in the game. So I'd like a lattice with five, you know, basis vectors, which are all equivalent. And if such a lattice exists, it's called the A4 star lattice. It's the fundamental weights of SU5, which is exactly how it occurs, actually, in the orbifold construction. That's how they see it. You can think of it as just taking a regular icotetrahedron and just going to the center and drawing the vectors out to the five vertices. So those are the basis vectors for A4 star. Those and their negatives. If you translate in all directions, you get A4 star. So you put the U's on five of them. Sorry?
Those U's dimensions. I mean,
we're in four dimensions, but this is a linearly dependent basis.
Yes, but this particular lattice, all the gauge theory were done. I don't know, quick history.
It's a nice lattice. It has lots of symmetry.
Well, it has a smaller symmetry group, a smaller discrete symmetry group than the
hypercube. No, it's bigger. It's fine. Yeah. It's a bigger symmetry group, actually.
Well, that one is 384 and S5 is 5 times 24, which is 120. So the other one is bigger. 3 is But I don't know whether in terms of projectional representations from up.
Yeah, I think it's cleaner because you can put this on a hypercubic lattice with body diagonals, but then you've mutilated a lot more symmetry.
Well,
so you don't want to do that. That's the sort of.
Every body diagonal appears in the
hypercubic. Yes, it's just like.
Every group will be bigger.
No, because if you can't rotate. If you put these diagonal links in general, you break the hypercubic symmetry down to something smaller.
That's why I ask you, if you put every body diagonal, then you don't break the symmetry. I mean, you take something symmetric and you do something symmetric to it, it will stay symmetric.
No, if I think about the two-dimensional example, I can no longer do 90-degree rotations because I don't, if I have this diagonal link here, right?
Every diagonal, the question is...
No, but I'm choosing them in a... It's not, they're not going in all directions.
It's
an orientation of the diagonal. In the two-dimensional example. Yeah, so that's...
Right, if you are doing less than
But this is the symmetric solution. You have a choice. In some sense, the lattices are somewhat forced on you by the construction. You don't have a free choice of lattice here. But in this case, you could choose hypercubic with all the body, with oriented body diagonals, or you can choose this.
One of the two by orientation.
In two dimensions, you can...
One of the two,
Right, here's your body cell. You don't have this guy.
Right, exactly.
So you don't have...
Yeah, that's like in the... When you do this... Korsen-Grimanko. You were talking about it.
All right. Okay, but the game is just the same. You put the U's on these links, you put the A's on the sides, that's sort of the degenerate case. The sides go on the same links as the U's, and the chi's go on these, new links, which are basically these space links, which are sums of these basis vectors, except that the orientation is opposite, just like in the two-dimensional example. But everything transforms like a zeumatic spectra, a linked object. Q squared equals 0 goes through just the same, and the derivative of the prescription is exactly the same. So everything I said before goes through for n equals 4. So if one understands the two-dimensional example, well, on the four-dimensional example is trivial, mm-hmm. Relatively. At least the construction level. So this is supersymmetric for the same reasons it was in 2D. What is really remarkable, I thought, when I first bumped into this, is that this Q closed piece can still be written down on the lattice in a way which is supersymmetric. And it's because this definition of F curly F, in terms of this V plus on U, satisfies an exact Bianchi identity, even in lattice variables. So configuration by configuration, this vanishes identically. Okay. So in other words, the argument that this is supersymmetric because of Bianchi works just as well on the lattice as it doesn't. So, and that's because of that particular definition of F, which is not the usual one in lattice CCD. But that's a really neat feature, I think.
The twisted SO symmetry is broken on the lattice.
Well, the full symmetry, you don't have obviously, before symmetry. You only have discrete subsets.
But do you have a discrete subset?
Yes, you have an S5, the permutation symmetry of this A4 star lattice vector. You can rotate the vectors into each other, or interchange any two vectors, and you get the same S. So the bottom line is the following. This twisting process exposes a nilpotent supersymmetry and induces a change of variables from the original gauge shield scalars and fermions spinners into these geometric objects. Some SUSY, at least in the WOM, supercharge can be preserved, including the interesting case of N equals 4. The lattice theories are just sums of gauge invariant loops, so everything, no problem there. There's no doubling, and you can show that analytically. In various ways, actually. But if you're a lattice QCD person, the easiest perhaps way is to show you can map theory into theory of reduced staggered fermions. Action is completely local. There's nothing funny or difficult or overlappish about this. It's very easy. The bosonic action involves FF dagger, so it's real, positive, definite, semi-definite. The fermions can be integrated out, and you get some Pfaffian. And then in principle, if this thing is positive, I can simulate with all the standard QCD algorithms. So that's what we do. So the question of whether this is positive, of course, is one of those issues that I'm talking about, remaining concerns. So I'll show you some information about that in just a second. And the hope is that having one exact supersymmetry, or indeed all of these theories have all these exact symmetries, that will be strongly constrained in possible fine-tunings that we have to do. Okay. And I'll show you one loop, in fact, it's enough.
This is an answerable question, exactly.
This?
How much fine tuning? It's just a question.
I can power count it out, and I'll show you that.
Yes, right.
But the question is, okay, we'll get to it in the next slide. Next couple of slides. So let me just say that explicitly. So it's crucial that we have to target the right theory that this U had a stable expansion around the unit matrix. Okay. Now normally in lattice QCD, the way you get this I, this unit matrix, is by expanding e to the a, and that guarantees it. But if you want to, in this case, it's much more natural to work with the U variables just in the algebra. Okay. Now you can do that here without breaking gauge invariance because this I can be interpreted as the VEV of a dynamical field. I have a UN symmetry and I have a complex gauge field. So this piece is just one of the components of the dynamical field. So I have to add at this point a gauge invariant potential which hedges the U's to 1, basically. So it picks out that vacuum point. And that's going to break supersymmetry. All this carefully constructed supersymmetry. So we have to be careful that this is not going to affect break everything, basically. All right, so this is very different from QCD. This is something I really realized only recently, in the last couple of years. Because we were originally trying to do this using exponentials, but then the measure gets kind of messy. We want to just use a flat measure on this.
So you might have got a non-compact.
It's a non-compact formulation of lattice gauge theory. It's not a generic one, because you have to have the UN theory, and you have to have scalar fields that form the imaginary parts of the connection. So it's not a generic prescription, but amazingly it gets around the usual issues. So you don't have to do what Wilson did.
So what's really the reason you are forced to do non-compact?
Because if you want to write down Q on U equals of psi, and you want them psi lives in the algebra, it's tricky. If you want a simple, naive transposition of those SUSY transformations for lattice. Or equivalently, if you want to write down a manifestly supersymmetric measure, the simplest thing is to put everything in the algebra, and then it's obvious that the measure is invariant under translations. So you don't have to worry about that.
The compact measure that you would
write. So I'm going to integrate over.
Would not be supersymmetric.
Not without fixing, at least by fixing, you'd have to put a Jacobian in to fix it up, which we
But is that a big problem?
No, you could do it, but it seems more natural just to stick with the algebra since you can do this.
It can be a problem.
What ensures finiteness?
Finiteness?
Convergence.
Oh, convergence. Dynamics is going to be the case, right? You're worrying about the flat directions and things like that. You have to suck it and see, I guess. We don't see a problem with the flat directions at all, actually. Once we fix this, once
do you have a natural strong compact expression?
We haven't thought about it. So you thought about it once. It's so, right?
Yeah. I think it's not trivial to do a strong coupling expansion because the couplings are fixed by supersymmetry.
Right. So you don't have the freedom that you would separate.
You would have to split them somehow, and then you would break supersymmetry.
Right. So I haven't really thought about it. Potentially, you could. if you think about it, maybe you can do something, but it's not, not
it's not trivial.
Not trivial.
And that's one of the advantages of the compact.
Well, there's nothing, I mean, we did, we have run simulations with the exponential form, just writing U as E to the A and not worrying about it too much. And actually the results don't change a whole lot. But this, I think theoretically it's easy to argue from this. And what, all the perturbative calculations is just assume we're in the algebra, right? Which is going to be in agreement at the leading order and the lattice spacing, but we might worry about higher order lattice spacing effects. So, so that's one issue. So you have to make sure you add a gauge invariant potential which pulls this out, or else you've got something supersymmetric that has nothing to do with the continuum theory. This is not just a question of stability of flat direction. You have to have exactly a VEV for the trace mode of the scalars if you want to do it this way. And this will break SUSY, and you have to worry about how SUSY is restored as you take that VEV, that potential away. Does the model have a sine problem? The Spaffian is generically complex. So can I do Monte Carlo at all? If its sine is fluctuating a lot, as we heard from Philippe, it's all kind of hopeless. I'll show you it doesn't look too bad, actually. I have some hand-waving arguments as to why that might be. And then this issue of fine-tuning, we're going to maintain 1 out of 16 SUSYs. So, you know, do the others come back for free as I take A to 0, or do I have to do more fine-tuning? It's presumably reduced from the any naive approach, but it still might be hard work. So fixing the VAD is the first thing I'll talk about. So what you can do is add this simple operator to the action. So this was something that was advocated originally by Hanada, I think, in a slightly different context, but it works beautifully here. So if I added something like this to the action, what happens is, and I expand, so I can then decompose the U's as an emission part times the unitary piece. So the unitary piece goes away in that limit. So I'm just sensitive just to the emission piece, which is basically to do with the scalars of leading order. Then if I just expand h around 1, then I can saturate this minimum. Furthermore, the fluctuations around that have an interesting form. Because of the trace here, the only piece that survives linearly is the trace mode. Everything else is quadratic. All the traceless modes are quadratic. So that's kind of interesting, because it means that when you square this guy, you have a mass term for this. If I hold mu fixed, the mass which becomes infinitely large as a goes to 0, it completely freezes the fluctuations of the trace mode. But in that same limit, the traceless modes just feel a quartic potential. So there's like a soft potential for the flat directions, but a very, very hard potential for the trace mode, the thing that I want to freeze completely. All right, so this operator has a very nice interpretation in that respect. Yeah. All right, so the idea is you'll add this term with some u squared, and then you take the continuum limit, so you decouple the trace mode fluctuations completely, they freeze out. This thing is, you have some infrared regulator on the flat directions, and then eventually you have to send, after taking the continuum limit, you have to send the u squared to 0. That would be the prescription. Okay? So here's some results. This is for the two-dimensional model with a U2 gauge group, so simplest thing you could do. So in this case, we're fixing the total coupling, the dimensionless version of the total coupling, lambda beta squared to the long. It doesn't matter what you fix it at, this is generically true. So here, the lattice spacing is basically 1 upon L. So large L is small lattice spacing. So first of all, we fix the value of mu. So for example, here's mu of 1.
That's not your C, you have an NC.
This is the temperature, if you want, or the, this is the dimensionless number. Lambda has a, you know, we're in two dimensions.
It usually has to do with 1 over x.
It's 2 color.
Yeah, so why do you call it? Okay, I just got confused.
Just think about it as u squared if you want. It doesn't matter.
Is it normal?
I'm not taking any large end limit here. So
yeah, so I just got it. Okay.
Okay, so I just fix that dimensionless number, and I send the number of lattice points to infinity, which is taking my lattice spacing to 0, everything scales canonically. And so everything levels out at some point, so I'm in the continuum limit, and then I send mu towards 0, and I approach this dotted line. This dotted line is one of the, is an exact value, sorry, I don't know what I'm measuring here. This is the expectation value of the bosonic action mobilized by the number of points. So it turns out this is related to Q ward identity. So we know exactly what its value should be, independent of the coupling constant. So what you can see is this, at least in two dimensions, this procedure is quite consistent. I can take the continuum limit and then extrapolate that to the supersymmetric limit by taking mu to 0. It the end. So I hold mu fixed and I take as a derivative.
Sorry, what goes mu?
Mu is this parameter in front of this Suzy breaking potential and constraint thing. Okay. So it's a dimensionless number because it's really mu times A. It's a lattice mass. So I'm holding the lattice mass fixed as I take the continuum limit, and that has the effect of freezing completely the fluctuations in the trace mode, and it's in a natural dimensionless number for a quartic potential in the, for the other node.
So in this case, you have other Feynman zero modes in this case, or the U-band gauge group.
Those are exact zero modes. You're right. So we have a thermal boundary condition to remove the fermion, exact fermion zero mode. Sorry, I didn't say that. There are ways to do it without doing that, but that's a simple way to do it.
How do you fix that zero mode, the boundary conditions?
Yeah, in this case. But there are ways you can do it without a boundary condition.
Well, that's a super symmetric,
right?
To lift the zero mode, you're super symmetric breaking boundary.
Yes, well, a thermal boundary condition will do that.
Breaks it. But still, it doesn't matter.
No. Well, I mean, basically that means that you need to be a very large lambda in the end to go back to zero temperature. So if you think about it, what you really want to do is take this parameter beta to infinity to approach the zero temperature supersymmetric limit. So I'm showing you one. So you should expect to see some breaking effects still. In fact, it's pretty small, it appears, at this level. I mean, we're not quite on the line, so maybe that's the, that, you know, the error bars are roughly the size of the symbol. They're just smaller than the symbol. So it seems precociously good, actually, given we're not at lambda, we use infinity.
I mean, L is 12, so...
Yeah, 12 by 12.
Less.
So you take, at the moment, you're taking the continuum limit with a non-zero temperature. And then, so you need to take mu to zero, and also lambda to infinity in the end, although we're just showing you a fixed lambda. There are ways to do this without a thermal boundary condition. You know, that's not a real requirement. All right, so we heard a lot about the sign problem a couple of days ago, and in general, one expects this Fabian is complex, and we need a positive definite measure to do Monte Carlo, and so I can always reweight. I can always say the full expectation value is the phase quenched guy throwing the phase in with the observable, just like we heard about, and then the denominator is just the average of the phase itself. And of course, if there are large fluctuations here, if this is winding around the unit circle, this is hopeless endeavor, basically. We have a huge statistical error. So it's crucial for practical purposes to know whether this is a problem or not. Otherwise, the whole program dies from a numerical perspective. So here's a picture showing you the absolute value of sine alpha. So that's something that's positive on every configuration, averaged over the ensemble, phase quenched ensemble, as a function of L. Same model, U2, Q is 4, lambda of 1, and same values of mu. So what you see is if mu is large, so you have a nice constraining potential, certainly the phase, this average is 0.05, it's small, but you can handle it by reweighting. Okay? You'll notice, in fact, for even mu of 1, everything is pretty fine. And in fact, it's going to 0 as you take the lattice space into 0. That's expected because this model has a positive definite Fatian in the Q equals 4 case. So you would expect down here to have no problem, and indeed that's what you see. You notice if you take a small value of mu, then in fact things go terrible for a while, but eventually they come down. So certainly there was no sign problem in this model, but you wouldn't have expected it here. The interesting case is 16.
Is this an average over lattices?
So I generate an ensemble of configurations with the phase quenched Fapien, and then I measure the absolute value of sine alpha
average
on that
lattices.
Average
the specific lattices for which it's large.
No, these are all lattices.
You averaged over many lattices.
You don't show a distribution.
I don't have a slide, but it's in the paper. But it's a very now. Yeah. So you might worry that there'd be some degeneracy because of the signs.
That
you, no. It's a tight distribution around zero. Unfortunately, I don't have a slide, but I assure you it's
the situation becomes better and better as you increase the system size.
Well, basically decrease the lattice spacing. But that's expected. This model is not meant, the four supercharged model has no sign problem, actually. So the down here we are, is correct. It's consistent with naive expectation. So in the continuum limit, the eigenvalues are paired lambda, lambda star. So there is a positive definite measure. But you can see, in practice, you could actually have modest problems if you're away from the continuum limit. Okay, so but the interesting question is what happens to the 16 supercharges when you don't have any, when you expect the factory to be complex.
Okay, did you take care of the case like zero mode?
The
case like zero mode.
There's a zero mode of the fermion?
Actually, there I think one exact zero mode.
Yes.
And three almost zero.
So we use the thermal boundary condition, which removes.
Okay, so you take care.
There is an exact zero mode, as So is saying, but we've removed it. In this case, with a thermal boundary condition. There are other choices. So this is the situation for 16, which is much more interesting. At first, you might say, well, it doesn't work. Everything's falling slowly with L, but then you notice the scale here, 10 to the minus 4. It's much easier than the 4 supercharge case. Okay, and for U2, you might say, well, there are special features about the U2 theory because of certain symmetries, and so this isn't the best example. We did this on larger ends, which are completely generic. And the situation is the same. The Fatian phase is very small. The fluctuations are extremely small, even away from the continuum limit. And the reason dynamically is that the scalar fields are sucked towards the origin much more strongly for 16 supercharges than they are for 4. So the width, if you looked at the eigenvalues of the scalars, which are what are giving you ultimately the Fatian phase, if I set the scalars to 0, there's no phase. So what happens is dynamics is sort of pushing the scalars into the origin at a fixed lattice spacing more strongly with a larger number of supercharges.
What's going on with the physical volume?
We're fixing lambda beta squared. So we're keeping the total coupling fixed in units of the volume or the area, which seems like the appropriate thing to do. We're fixing one dimensionless number, which is the ratio of the total coupling to the area.
So that looks like you're working from a finite volume at the end of the
day. Yes. So it's all related to, again, this question of zero temperature. So if I take large and larger values of this parameter.
These are asymmetric matrices?
No, these are L by L, the symmetric.
So you are doing a finite.
We're doing finite volume, taking a lot of space with zero.
The unit of the thing would be a finite torus.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Where the size of that torus is related to the size of this other parameter lambda, lambda beta squared.
So if you have
it's a continuum torus.
The aspect is fixed.
The aspect is fixed.
So it's periodic.
And the size of the torus, if you want in physical units, is being controlled by lambda beta squared.
So if you have small phase fluctuations in a finite volume of a given size. Mm-hmm. And so in that size, it looks controllable. Mm-hmm.
No, so what you're saying is...
As you make the physical volume larger, right, aren't you assured that you're going to have problems which become exponentially bad in large volume?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a question of varying this parameter. If you take large values of this parameter, it is certainly true that this number gets worse. And that's really the statement I think you're talking about. How does this vary with this parameter? Then the question is, what's a physically reasonable value of this parameter? When you were doing infinite volume physics, I guess is what you're saying. For what value of lambda beta squared?
I'm almost certain. I mean, any determinant basically is that the phase is an extensive variable and it goes exploring.
Well, but there's something very special about the configurations here, which is driven by the dynamics. So I think that. So let me.
Well, why should the model in the continuum limit has the same?
If you throw in a generic gauge field, there is a sign problem. There is a it's complex, no question. So the question is, does the path integral, does the majority of the path integral get dominated by configurations for which are not generic? So that would be the argument. So let me give you an argument as to why that might be. Okay. The point is that this object here, which is really controlling the problem, the expectation value of this, is really just a full partition function, which is a topological invariant. So you can actually go compute this ratio in one loop, right? Exactly.
This depends on your boundary conditions, right?
I move to periodic, otherwise I would have a problem. So this is not we don't have an exact topological symmetry anyway because we're adding this potential to constrain the scalar. So this is not to be taken, this is not completely kosher. But roughly speaking, if I forget about the potential and I throw back periodic boundary conditions, then the lattice Z we have is a sort of regularized form of Witten index. It's a topological index. But it's related to the bed of e to the I alpha. All right? So the only way this can be true is if alpha strictly is restricted to be 0 on the important configurations. So I do a semi-classical limit, then I have to, and I find this is the calculation we've done. So you can expand around a generic point in the moduli space, and you'll see the boson and fermion determinants vacuums cancel, and there is no sign of a phase at one loop. And then you can boost that theory, that calculation to arbitrary through all orders, because this is at least Z, at least is the topological invariant. So it can be computed. So that calculation is valid for any data, for any couplings. So presumably the small fluctuation we're seeing are related to the fact we are breaking Suzy via the boundary condition and via the potential we put in with non-zero mu. And so we don't find an alpha. We don't find a saturated on alpha zero, but we find small alphas. Yeah.
Is it only phase two or more general
n? This is true generally. It doesn't matter what time it is. So, I mean, I offer this up as a partial explanation. I think that
probability of configurations with a non-vanishing phase would have to strictly vanish in a continuum. Mm-hmm. In apparent contradiction to just looking at your expression.
Well, it says that the dominant configurations inside the pattern will have to have zero alpha.
I'm just trying to emphasize dominant. He doesn't say by some factor of four nines. It means.
Well, there are two aspects to this. One is, is it really alpha zero? And the other one is, it just small enough we can handle it by reweighting? So this.
But this argument, right? I mean, this is a very strong argument. I mean, you're saying that expectation value is either exactly.
But it's very delicate. It's very delicate because this doesn't really formally exist unless I put that potential in, right? So I have to break the topological symmetry to know what I'm doing to make sure the z means something. So I regulated the infrared directions, that the infrared divergences associated with the flat directions. In order to define what I mean by this. But then some limit when mu goes to zero, if I can change limits, then this argument holds. And I don't know how legitimate any of that is. Yeah, it's something true.
So if it were legitimate, this argument can be made in the continuum theory.
Yes. Well, although in fact, I think that the twist of n equals 4 we're using is this twist by Marcus back in, he was the first person to write this twist of n equals 4 down. And in his paper, he has a lot of arguments that on the torus, z counts the number of isolated vacuum states of the theory without sign. So it's a sum of positive numbers. So in the continuum, there is some sort of argument out there that this should not suffer from the worst type of sign problem. You have a sign problem in lattice field theory if z has to be zero because of some cancellations. And there is an argument in the continuum that's not the case.
But
I don't understand that paper fully, so I couldn't.
This is a Z that you expect that after putting a couple of things to infinity very carefully.
Yeah, yeah. And his argument is not rigorous, I think, in that sense either, because he hasn't defined it. We're in control of the integrals here, but we don't know whether we're in control of this anymore. So
that's it's good.
The usual thing. Anyway, there are reasons for optimism, let's say it like that. This is also only, the new character is all in two dimensions. So you go to four dimensions and we haven't been able to simulate big enough lattices and compute the vacuum to know what's going on. And it could be that it gets worse. I know on very small lattices it's fine, in like 3 to the 4th or something, but I don't know as you go bigger whether it's practical or not.
So the gauge potentials in your problem are complexified.
Yep.
And if I understood correctly, the imaginary part of the gauge potential is associated with some bosonic fields.
In the end, when you run twisted, it's
so the absence of sign problem means the action is actually real, and that would imply that these bosonic fields are dynamically suppressed and go to zero. Is there any physical reason for that to happen?
Not that I know of. I mean, I'll show you in a second if I have time, but in fact you can compute the moduli space in the lattice theory, and it's modulo this potential business. The effective potential is zero to all orders in the coupling constant by the same types of arguments that we're making here. So in fact it's flat even under renormalization. So it's actually a bit surprising that the scalars are localizing around the origin, right? Because it's not the, it's not coming from the effective potential. It must be some kinetic issue.
It's coming from your
Well, I mean, there's a regulator as well. So the point is, when I take the regulator away, it's a bit surprising that, which is what Philip's saying, that they end up making.
You have finite temperature, right?
Yeah.
So a
finite temperature. None of that depends on this. I can switch that off and control the zero modes and other.
No, if you put that equal 4 at finite temperature, then there's more entropy and all the lines are together. And that wants to have the configuration start there. So that's really the dynamics. But if you make it truly super symmetric, it's viable.
I don't know. All right. So let me say a few more words about fine-tuning, and then I'll try to wrap up. So the fine-tuning issue, of course, is one of the things that you're most interested in, and how much tuning do you need to do to get full supersymmetry in the continuum limit. So you have a bunch of exact symmetries on the lattice, the stage invariance, the exact supersymmetry built in. You have this rather large or rather small, depending on your perspective, point group symmetry for the A4 star lattice. This is certainly a subgroup of SO4 prime. So I think in that sense, you can guarantee very quickly that this will guarantee that the full SO4 prime is restored, the full twisted rotation symmetry in the continuum limit, automatically. So that part is okay. There's also a fermionic shift symmetry here, which I didn't point out, but it's true nevertheless. You can shift the eta field by a constant proportional to this unit matrix and the actions invariant. So if you use those exact symmetries and you power count out possible relevant operators, what you find is that the only gauge invariant, Q invariant operators which respect all of these symmetries basically already exist in the lattice action. So it's renormalizable in that formal sense. So the worst case that can happen is that the coupling constants can shift away from the canonical values, the ones you started with, by radiative effects. So we did a one loop calculation to see how bad this shifting in the alphas was, and I'll stop. Skipping to the end of that and telling you what the answer is, we find in fact the alphas all renormalize the same way. And we did a long, tedious calculation to show that, and we were surprised by it, but now we have a quick argument as to why that is, in fact, that one loop, why that's true. Beyond one loop, it probably is not true. However, at worst, these are logarithmic flows. So there are three logarithmic ratios that you might have to tune, and in the very worst scenario, even at strong coupling, assuming you can trust power counting. And I'll just sketch also the fact we did the calculation of the effective action at one loop as well, which is about, and that's also zero, remains zero to all orders. So the perturbation theory is standard, so I'm not going to spend any time on it. The lattice action, because it's supersymmetric, has nice features. So when I look at the inverse of the fermion matrix in k-space, it's just the original fermion matrix times one over k squared, where this is k hat is the usual. There it is, sine squared k over 2 thing that arises in lattice perturbation. So it has the same structure as the continuum. It's just this is the same thing you would have in the continuum. So there are nice features about the lattice perturbation theory that are not there in QCD, perhaps. But other than that one, just one can choose a boson to be diagonal in an ANA bar like that. It's just fixing gauge the right way. And you have to basically do 4 one-loop Feynman graphs to find these alphas. Sorry, to find 3 of the alphas, and then you need to do a vacuum polarization for the final alpha. I'm certainly not going to show you that. I'm just going to speak to the answer. So here's one example. So for example, there's a Kaikai propagator. You have to look at its renormalization. So you need to, this is one of the diagrams that can be inserted in between. That diagram depends on these vertices, which you can extract expressions from your lattice action. What you find is, and I tailor a span around the external momentum, the leading one term is zero, so there's no mass induced. And the term linear in P, the wave function renormalization, goes logarithmically in U times A, and U is an infrared cutoff with coefficient U squared. And generically, you'd expect the coefficient down here to depend on the propagator I'm looking at. But in fact, what you find is that all the alphas, all of these renormalization constants, come out to be the same A. And that was a surprise to us for a long time. In fact, it was really the work of a student of mine, Robert Wells, that did this. I would never have gotten this answer. He's very, very precise. So we realized why it was, because we were so naive. I'm not used to doing lattice perturbation theory. The point is, in this, the one-loop lattice diagram is in one-to-one correspondence with continuum diagrams, and they have only long divergences. So if you talk to anyone who's an expert in lattice perturbation theory, they would have immediately known the answer. Because what happens is the divergences all come from where the lattice momentum is near zero. When that's the case, at one loop, everything collapses to a continuum expression, and so the divergences are the divergences you find in the continuum theory in the same scheme. And you know the continuum theory, it's just a change of variables, and it has full supersymmetry. So it must also be true, so therefore all the wave function normalizations in the continuum have to have a common form. Otherwise I couldn't reassemble spinners out of my twisted fermions. Because I put different twisted fermions together in the same when I construct my spinners in my untwisted theory. So they have to renormalize the same way, or else I wouldn't be able to do that. Right? So we think we really understand what's going on now. It's guaranteed that this will happen. And in fact, if you go through the same arguments in the continuum, you'll see that the one-loop diagrams that contribute to the beta function in the lattice theory, the divergent structure of that is the same as in the continuum. And so, since the continuum beta function vanishes, the lattice beta function must also vanish at one loop.
But that's particular to this theory. I mean, that wouldn't be true for an I.
Oh, no. No, as far as I know, this is the only non-trivial looking lattice theory which has vanishing beta function at one loop. Yeah. I mean, this probably will not be true at higher loops. It cannot be. You know that. But at least at one loop, you know, you have an anchor point.
So why wouldn't experts have understood this?
Because they know that the divergences in the lattice perturbation theory, if it's only log divergences, they're common to the continuum. That's apparently an old piece of folklore. And it's sort of obvious. When you look at the expressions, the divergence is coming from a region momentum space where all these phase factors that occur in lattice perturbation theory and all these sine squares all collapse just to continuum structure. So you're doing the same interval you'd be doing in the continuum. The divergence is coming from the same. So therefore, you're doing continuum theory at one loop, effectively. And so you know the continuum theory is just a change of variable, so you have full supersymmetry. That means you have to have a common wave function normalization, and that's what we see.
And this calculation is at mu equals zero.
No, you have to put a regulator in, just like that, in mu.
And so all these statements are true at finite.
The divergence is log mu a. You have to have something to go with a to give you the log. And it's an infrared regulator.
Sorry.
It's presumably essentially the same effect we were having to put in for the simulation, essentially. So the theory only makes sense when you put an infrared regulator in, and then that's how the divergence is manifested.
Is this the result for A4 lattice?
This is for A4 lattice.
And what if you use this Q-ring lattice?
Then it would be a mess, because you'd lose a lot of the point group symmetry, so there'll be more counterterms in the first place, I suspect. I mean, so we kind of assume that we're only having to worry about four alphas. There would be more alphas to start with if we weren't using A4 star, I think. Just to give you a sketch of how the calculation of the effective action is just like you would do in the continuum. So the bosonic vacua in this theory, so fermions are zero, the bosonic vacua are constant complex commuting matrices, so diagonal matrices if you want. Okay, that's just as it would be in the continuum. So I can expand the UVs about not only the one, but one of these generic diagonal complex matrices with some fluctuations, expand to quadratic order, integrate them out. Not surprisingly, the five bosons give you the determinant to the minus five of some quadratic operator. It involves now d minus and d plus. Because the background is commuting, these derivatives, all difference operators, actually all commute. So it's a great simplification when you start constructing figure the fermions to realize that These operators, which in general would not commute on a generic background, this background, everything commutes. So if you go to momentum space, it's very, very similar to the continuum calculation. If you take the ghosts that you get from gauge fixing plus the fermions, you get a single determinant of the same operator for the ghosts. You get this vacuum guy, and then you go to Maple or Mathematica, and it reduces to this, if you're Joel B. He had like 40,000 terms, and he subtracted them, and he got zero. He says, the answer's zero. I can't do it in my hand. But so he put in this and subtracted it off and asked Mathematica to work it out. So in other words, these two cancel, as you have to, because of the Q-symmetry. So the bosonic and fermionic fluctuations cancel in the lattice theory. So perhaps not surprising. There's no sign of a phase that arises in these manipulations, actually, at all. And so you find that Z is one, in one loop. Because Z is a topological invariant, you can bootstrap to all orders, and so you expect that the moduli space in the lattice theory survives to orders just like in the continuum. If you formally, because I haven't said much about these flat directions or anything like that, but formally this is true, just as it is formally in the continuum, I think, I believe. Okay, so I'm not throwing the details at you, but it goes through in a way similar to the argument about the phase. All right. Okay, so in the last few minutes, let me just give you one example of how you can use this type of construction to approach these problems in holography. So with Toby, we did some work on quantum mechanics, but some of that work was done with non-supersymmetric actions. So I wanted to show you a bona fide case of using this construction I talked about. So we looked at n equals 4 dimension reduced to 2 dimensions on a torus of sizes Rx and R tau. This thing is meant to be dual to a theory of black strings in type 2 supergravity. And what's expected from the supergravity analysis is that this black string solution is not always stable. Sometimes it breaks down into black hole solutions. So there are different, the minimum, if you wanted, the free energy, depends on the ratio of Rx and R tau in some way. In some region, you get a black string. In other regions, you get a black hole. So that's called the Gregor-Leflam transition in the gravitational theory. And it just depends on the ratio of R tau to Rx squared. This number C is not known, I believe, at the moment from the continuing supergravity analysis. But we'll see if we can fit our data and extract a C from it. In the Gibbs theory, of course, this Gregor-Leflam transition is some sort of thermal phase transition in the Gibbs theory. And in fact, what it corresponds to is a breaking of center symmetry in the spatial directions, which is signaled by a spatial polycoff loop. Okay.
C is dimensional?
Yeah, it must be. Yeah. So that's the expectation, if you want. This is all at low temperature and large N and all that sort of stuff. So we can simulate on a different aspect ratio tori. So we can vary Rx and R tau. We can vary the coupling constant. So in fact, what we do is not vary these two separately. We vary the ratio, keep the ratio. This is one variable, and the total coupling is the other. What do you mean?
There's no square on the right hand side. I mean, C should be an inverse length.
These are dimension-wise with the coupling. Because you're in two dimensions, yeah. Rx and R tau are dimensionless. And then supergravity, when you do all the fiddling around, predicts this phase transition in the region where supergravity should be good. R tau should go like Rx squared, right. And there's some coefficients, which if you knew the black hole solutions, you would know, but actually no one's computed them yet. I mean, that's a classical gravity problem, so if on the lattice you can determine what C is, you've actually made a prediction for classical gravity, which is, I think, novel.
It's going in the dirty direction.
Yeah, it's going in the opposite direction. Really?
Is it easy to understand why it does like a square?
Well, maybe.
I think I is. I don't think it is, right?
Well, no. It's not that complicated. But it involves understanding
something come out very well, unfortunately. So this is meant to be, I think this is Rx alone. This is not used at all. Fine on my laptop, but it doesn't come up. Rx and R tau on the x and y axes. Forget about the blue line for a second, the kind of dirty looking dashed line is the boundary between the two different thermal phases in the Gibbs theory. So one side of the phase, the polycoff line is large, the other side of that boundary is small. So we just set the boundary level, boundary as being where the polycoff line has value 0.5, so halfway between 1 and 0. Okay, so what you see is that you can fit to this quadratic function this sort of phase boundary between the sort of the spatially deconfined and the spatially confining phases. And from that, you can even extract a C. There's no error bar in it because it's really a very pretty precise measurement. But nevertheless, that's the ballpark number. And so you see this transition, which will be the correspondent to the Gregor-Leflam transition. You can fit it to the high temperature expansion down here. Up here, you can fit it to this quadratic form and extract a C. This is at least one example where you could start to use these sort of supersymmetric Yang-Mills simulations to actually tell you something about in this case, the gravitational side from aspects of the thermal behavior of the Gibbs theory.
The red curve is not a bar.
No, that corresponds to what you get for a high temperature dimensional reduction.
Yeah, what's the shape of a third power?
Oh.
Yeah, I think our tag is like RX cubed.
Right.
And that you can understand.
So you see it matches up with this graph, the fit we get in as well. So you can imagine a single curve that goes between them, which is not different asymptotic behaviors. All right, so that's just one example. I sort of concludes some almost out of time. So lattice theories of exact supersymmetry are possible, contrary to sort of folklore that existed for a long time, in particular in N=4, which is the one we're most interested in here, of course. The key is to discretize a topologically twisted form of the continuum theory that allows you to maintain some supersymmetry and avoid all the problems I talked about in the first couple of slides. This SUSY is enough already to ensure the moduli space survives all orders of perturbation theory, at least formally, and there's no fine-tuning required to take full to get a supersymmetric continuum limit, full supersymmetric continuum limit, at least at one loop. There are a lot of subtleties that we've been laboring with recently. It's necessary to add some sort of gauge numeric potential to freeze this trace node out and regularize the flat directions. We think we can do that well in two dimensions. It's an untested issue as to how well that will work in four dimensions. There's a possible sign problem, but it doesn't seem so bad so far. At least, again, in two dimensions, where it's easy to do the numerics. The exploration of the phase diagram in the four-dimensional theory is underway right now. I have nothing to show you, unfortunately, yet. And eventually, one would like, of course, to use these sorts of lattice constructions to tell you something about ADS, VFT, and such matters like that.
Is the formalism also applicable to four-dimensional n=2 span?
N equals 2?
Yeah.
No, unfortunately not. You need the full n equals 4. Basically, you have to end up with a full Kähler Dirac field, essentially. Or if you could do n equals 2, you'd have fewer fermions, which would mean that you're essentially doing better than reduced staggered fermions. That's one way of seeing that it can't work.
But we can use the Topolsky's.
In the continuum, there's a topologically twisted form, but when you try to translate that using the rules, you know, operationally that I gave you onto the lattice, you'll find that it involves the dual fields. And the dual fields mess up the gauge invariance properties because the index structure no longer corresponds to the way the thing transforms on the lattice, and that's what wrecks you. You lose gauge invariance. But you can sort of argue it in many ways.
Yeah. And in the previous slide, n was how much? The gauge
value?
Yeah, 3 and 4.
Yeah, we didn't.
You get fairly consistent answers between 3 and 4, but it's very small still. I think.
Yeah.
One of the things particularly when you're looking at thermodynamics is, I mean, as people have done large n know, I mean, if you're looking at, I mean, with this level of accuracy, n of 4 is already.
Yeah. The quantum mechanics claims n equals 5 was already hard to distinguish from n equals 10.
And I mean,
with the level of statistical error that we have, it's. There's no point in running a large random unless you're going to do a better job with the statistics.
Okay. Could you go back again to your sign problem, Nancy?
Yeah, so might as well look at the 16 one, I guess.
If I understand correctly, as you go to the right, the lattice spacing shrinks like 1 over L.
Yep.
But mu, what you call mu, is actually a mu, because mu is a...
Yes, but we're holding mu fixed. That was the key point. So we're actually holding mu fixed as we take a to 0, which means that the physical mass of that trace mode actually goes to infinity, goes to the car.
But you were holding a mu fixed.
So, we're holding a mu fixed as we take
a to 0. So as a goes to 0, mu...
Yes.
Increases, so the breaking of your supersymmetry induced by this factor mu becomes stronger. So as you go to the right, to the continuum limit, you have a stronger and stronger breaking of the supersymmetry, and that's what saves you, I presume.
But one thing important is introduced master molecule U1 part.
Yeah, I mean, it's a leading order where
SU2 part.
That mass that you're worrying about is only affecting the trace mode, which decouples in the naive continuum limit. Normally, you don't even worry about the U1 piece, right? It decouples from the SU.
But shouldn't the proper procedure to take a mu constant? So mu going like 1 over L in your notation here.
Well, we have not explored that because we were trying to use a potential which basically just froze the trace mode at this canonical value and took it out of the dynamics. You're right, it breaks supersymmetry, but it does it in a sector which is decoupled in the continuum limit. So it becomes a subtle issue as to whether that Suzy breaking feeds in or not. And actually, it would be interesting to do something like you say and try the different limits and see whether you can get it.
Increasing mu does not make it worse.
A mu should decrease like 1 over n as you go to the right.
I mean, what we tend to do, what you see actually is that you actually numerically take mu down. In fact, whether you're running at mu equals, let's see now, you see it's rather insensitive to mu if you notice at some point. It's easier to see perhaps on the with high statistics of the score guy, right? At some point. And these two sets of curves don't differ by very much, and yet the mu factor, remember it's mu squared, which is the parameter, differs by a factor of 100. So at some point it seems to be insensitive to the value of mu as long as it's non-zero. Right?
Actually, we introduced the same mass term for Kaplan and Unzel's model.
They use a slightly different mass term than this one. I think.
Yeah. So the same, almost the same mass term for U1 part. We tried that simulation and compare it with Sugino's SU2 lattice, which does not require such mass term under four.
Right.
And even with extremely large mu, we observed perfect agreement. So somehow this U1 part really decouples and does not affect SU2 part. Of course. It's not easy to justify theoretically, but numerically.
But that coupling is through terms of order the lattice spacing. Couplings of the SUN sector to the UN sector are already suppressed by powers of the lattice spacing. So it's a question of how those two effects play out.
And,
I mean, you're right to be worried.
One comment about sine problem. And I saw you did the simulation for 0 to plus 1 dimension, and also we did. And actually, at extremely strong coupling or extremely low temperature, sine problem does appear. But before sine problem becomes severe, we can see very nice agreement with gravity dual. So even in 2 dimensions or perhaps in 4 dimensions, before sine problem becomes really severe, we can see nice agreement with dual, I think.
To me, I mean, the question is what happens if I take lambda beta squared to be 10? And I would claim you're still, this scale will change, maybe it'll be 10 to the minus 3, or a little bit bigger, but it's still something you can handle on this sort of scale of lattice size. And it would be very surprising to me if you had to take, the physical regime had this parameter of 100 or 1,000 or something, where you really ran into the sine problem. So it would be kind of unusual to have such a large dimensionless number being sort of somehow the,
I'm confused. Let's better back in 2 dimensions. Oh, you're in
2 dimensions.
Okay. There you have a dimension for coupling.
Uh-huh.
So in this limit, is the volume getting small as L goes to infinity in physical units?
I mean, the only thing that's really relevant is the ratio of the total coupling to the area, right? I mean,
right.
So that's what I'm fixing here with lambda beta squared. So I'm not sure the absolute size is the relevant thing. You should think about how is the size relative to the magnitude of the total coupling or the gauge coupling.
So when that turns, the volume is being held still.
Well,
when you're squeezing the volume, if you're squeezing the volume as you do this, then it's not surprising that the phase gets smaller, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you really get some physical volume, right?
Yeah.
And then see what happens. Is that what you're doing?
That would correspond to doing this for different values of this parameter.
Yeah. So fixing that,
so what I'm, fix right, and what I'm arguing is that the dangerous region is when this gets very large.
Yeah.
But I know that up to sort of modest values of this, this qualitative conclusion does not change.
And when you go to 4 dimensions where it's conformal, how do you ask this question?
Well, of course, you don't know how the lattice, you have to determine the lattice spacing non-trivially in 4 dimensions. It's not just 1/L. So. But then you have to know the phase diagram, you have to locate phase transitions, you have to worry about how to take the continuum limit, just like in PCD. And then you have to move along the appropriate trajectory and then worry about it.
I'm worried about whether I know that this phase is really small in a big volume, whatever that means.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we don't even know what the phase diagram looks like in 4D. I mean, it's not going to be one phase, presumably, at least not naively, because it's strong, it's a very large lattice spacing, a strong coupling, if you want. The thing's going to be confining. It's a lattice gauge theory. So it'll have a confining region, and hopefully it's got another region which is asymptotes to conformal in some appropriate large beta, large volume limit, and then maybe phase transitions between those two. or at least strong crossovers. So we don't know what even that is. So somehow you have to figure that out and sit in the right phase to take the continuous
moment. When you change A, the sizes doesn't change. Doesn't change.
Coupling
doesn't change.
The
Lagrangian change.
Right.
Somehow
also
different terms in Lagrangian
become different. Alpha is the argument that they're universal falls away because this argument that everything reduces to a continuum form doesn't hold it when you go beyond one loop. So there will be some flow. I would imagine there's some flow in any of those couplings, some log flow. My feeling at the moment is that what will happen is you position yourself in the right phase of the model, so you determine the correct phase to be in to take continuum physics, and then as you increase, so as you block the system, suppose I did real space RG, there will be some flow in these alphas initially, and at some point the flow would stop. You get to within the basin of attraction of this one loop result, and then the flows would stop, and where you ended up with on this, you know, what the value of the renormalized coupling would be, would depend sort of on where you started in some non-trivial way, and you could flow to different points on that fixed point line, depending on. But you may have to do some tuning to get there as well. You may not flow there. In fact, it would be almost remarkable if you did get there with no tuning. But the tuning at least is at worst logarithmic, so it's not really fine tuning in the usual sense. It's not like a Higgs mass or something.
It's gridlined a flouncing, so you have a black scene which is sort of spread around, and then it decides to break up into sort of things which are more like lumps.
Yep.
And this is all captured by the eigenvalues of the Korenkov loops on the other side.
Yes.
So we're talking about the same thing. What's that eigenvalue distribution?
What's amazing is that So you would need some effective potential for these guys that sort of it gives you at least that it has to be a parabola on the critical line. Right? Is there a way to... I mean, naively I'm thinking about this Rx and Ry, and then you break it up, this thing which is sort of, a sheet, you break it up into lumps, then this Rx and Ry has something to do with their shape. I mean, how many of those you... Why is it that the system decides to make it, that it is... At some point, the system decides it doesn't pay to have this thing, it pays to have this X. And these...
I guess it all comes down to entropy.
Well, the entropy
in the gravity, the simplest way to
it's free
it.
Energy, and the free energy I'm assuming. Yeah, so free energy.
But in the gravity case, it's just a question of.
So the free energy is just a function of angles, and it has a minimum. And I'm trying to understand. Where is Rx and Ry there? I mean, why is this parabola? This has to do something with the shape of the things, I imagine. This Rx goes like Ry squared. Must tell you somehow that this sort of more localized black holes are like an ellipse or something.
No, I mean, I don't. In this strong coupling region, I don't know how you understand the power law. I mean, that weak coupling, the fact that it goes like a cubic is easy to understand.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe we
don't. But I don't know strong. Yeah,
but there is gravity calculation.
Well, the gravity calculation is very interesting because actually, if you think about black holes and Kaluza climbs, there is a pure gravity just with one dimension compact at this. Two types of black hole, one smeared over the circle and one not. And if you just do Kaluza-Klein theory in 10 dimensions with one compact circle, but still vacuum gravity, there's a simple solution generating technique that turns those solutions into these dual solutions. So it's a very, very simple gravity problem. Mm. That's all it is. And I mean, it's slightly embarrassing that I've not managed to calculate those black holes.
Nobody has managed to perturb that system and check, see if there is a Gregor Lafamme.
Oh, no. So I checked that. Yeah. So there's a Gregor Lafamme instability. But because it's a first order transition, seeing that unstable point doesn't give you the phase transition point.
yeah. Right? Because it's first order, not second order. So you actually need to construct these the more complicated phase which dominates.
I see. You have to calculate two things and equal the
exactly. And one of them is calculated, and one of them becomes unstable, but you have to calculate the other one.
Well, it becomes unstable. It's not.
And we haven't done that yet. So you have a bound on
it. Dies before it becomes.
The bound is gravity predicts from that linear calculation that c should be bigger than 2, and you find 3.5. But you don't have an actual value of what it should be. That's why Simon had this inequality.
And is this still?
But it's an embarrassing, and it's a peculiar gravity problem. You wouldn't think, that's obviously going to have some gravity tool that's interesting, which is why no one sort of computed it. But it's peculiar what gets related to what in this sort of thing.
Have questions? Yes, Mr. Berger.